Blog Talk Radio.
Afternoon, everybody. Unfortunately, we couldn't do this live on Monday due to a server error from Blog Talk Radio, but thankfully we are back up here today as this is the Four Eastings Fire American Soccer Show, as we will now review the 1-1 draw between the United States and Wales in this World Cup group stage match. And it was a very interesting one. You can say a tale of two halves. And joining me right now, of course, currently Pac-12 sports announcer and former Fox Soccer Channel presenter and play-by-play man, Christian Miles. Of course, from World Soccer Talk, we have Robert Hay. And, of course, joining us a little bit later on, and hopefully he'll make it right now, Carter Krishnayer from World Soccer Talk, both of them from World Soccer Talk as we get ready for this one. As we've already said, 1-1 draw, tale of two halves. And, Christian, from your point of view, what did you make of this matchup between both the U.S. and Wales? I thought an excellent opening 45 and then maybe a little bit left to be desired that second half.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that's kind of been the consensus here. A lot of praise has been heaped on the U.S. for their display in the first half. I take a little bit of issue with that. While the play was good between the boxes, I don't think the U.S. offered up enough inside the penalty areas and had some questionable moments defensively. And second half, I thought the change, bringing on the big, strong striker for Wales and pinning him up against that U.S. central defensive partnership, kind of allowed them to play a little bit more directly. The U.S. didn't have an answer. I thought Rob Page got the best of Greg Berhalter in terms of in-game adjustments. The U.S. didn't have a response to that. And as a result, you know, Wales looking like the team that was probably going to go on and win it in comparison to the U.S. So all in all, though, it's not doom and gloom. The U.S. do have a point, but this is, you know, a point gained, but 2 points lost, moreover, and the U.S. really should have come out on the victorious end. I would like to commend the Welsh. I thought they were brilliant. I thought they defended well by and large. You know, Hearts of Lions, a team that was without its midfield general and Joe Allen. So a job well done to them and a tip of the hat to the Welsh.
You know, I got to say, Robert, and I do agree with Christian absolutely about that. And but on that first half, I mean, the U.S. was on fire. The U.S. was attacking. The U.S. was doing some wonderful things with the ball. They were just showing you why this young core is going to be dangerous for the years and years to come for the U.S. men's national team and for the U.S. program. I mean, what was about that first half that really excited you when taking on one of the top teams in the United Kingdom?
Yeah, well, first, Daniel, great to be on with you. Great to be on with Christian, who I'm a huge fan of. So always want to get that out of the way first. One thing I did for this match was I mixed it up a little bit, and I actually listened to the UK broadcast. I wanted to get their perspective as to what was going on because, you know, I just wanted to hear something different. And I'll tell you what, it was about as depressing of a first half broadcast that I've ever heard. You know, bemoaning, you know, this is the worst that we've seen Wales play and so on and so forth. And I think there's something to that. You know, I put on Twitter at halftime, you know, I'm glad that the U.S. got a goal because there's no way Wales could play any worse than what we saw on the first half. I mean, this is a good, you know, good side, world-class quality players when they're on, but they just showed no real, you know, desire to bring the game to the U.S. And so that really played into the U.S.'s hands, and you know, in terms of attacking, you know, prowess, and it played to some of the U.S.'s strengths. I mean, obviously Christian Pulisic was very good in the first half, really controlling the ball and giving the Wales some problems. And then, you know, the Wales goal was just, you know, a great I mean, that really shows what this team can do when given space to perform. And so I think what we saw in that first half was some of the good that this U.S. team can do, how its interplay and how its speed can really cause problems for teams. But I think we'd be remiss if we didn't highlight the fact that Wales just came out with a horrible game plan and came out really flat and allowed the U.S. to do that. And I think, you know, it sounds really conceited and full of myself to sit there and say, I really wish we would have gotten a second goal against, you know, our world-class, you know, European side. But, man, a second goal in that first half would have been really, really great. As it turned out, you know, a 1-1 draw is what we got.
Mm-hmm. And Carl Kirshner, of course, is with us from World Soccer Talk, and, you know, he's going to give a little more in-depth as well because of his knowledge of what's going on with the players from Wales, and that do play, the majority of the roster plays in the Premier League and, of course, the Championship, Football Leagues 1 and 2, as well as welcome to Wrexham. But anyway, Cardiff, you know, when you saw that... Rob McElhaney is not here, so we unfortunately don't have him. But if I could ask you this, Cardick, what made you think when that starting 11 was brought out from the Welsh manager, did you feel that this was advantage USA right off the get-go, or did you think that this was going to be more of a challenge for the U.S.?
Absolutely, I thought it was going to be advantage USA. I want to echo Robert's sentiments. It's great to be on the show with Christian, who I've been a huge fan of for many, many years, going back to the Fox Soccer Channel days. And it's great to be reunited with Robert, who we've had a great partnership on these shows through the years, but haven't done one together in a number of years. So thank you, Daniel, for bringing us all together. When I saw Rob Page's lineup, I actually kind of said, okay, Wales is conceding, and I got talked off the ledge by a couple of people who I know know British football pretty well, saying, well, he thinks that he can maybe get the U.S., who's a high-energy team, to run themselves out in the first half and then make the changes needed in the second half, which is kind of how the match played out. But I don't understand not starting Kiefer Moore from the get-go. He's such a unique player in international football in terms of his height and mobility, because he's big, he's strong, but he's also very mobile as a striker. Now you can drop Bale a little deeper and maybe get him more touches. And then the decision to start Dan James over Brennan Johnson is who I would have started in that case, was also controversial. But, yes, Christian makes a very good point also about Joe Allen, who is the heart and soul of the Welsh team, as much as we talk about Gareth Bale. He's the engine, being injured and not being a big factor in this match. But I do think it was advantage USA, and the U.S. handled that first half really well, and probably should have gotten a second goal at some point. We know, as both Christian and Robert have said, that Wales is of a certain standard, both in qualifying and in the Nations League. Even though they got relegated from their group, they played the Netherlands and Belgium very tough in those matches. So they're of a certain high standard, and you knew you were going to see a much better Wales, irrespective of tactical changes in the second half. And when you have a team like that that you know can beat you on the rope, you've got to finish them off. And the U.S. just didn't do that.
Sorry about that. My microphone was a little off there. Sorry about that, guys. As Christian, I was trying to say was, and I agree with Cardick and everyone else, that the substitution that brought in Kiefer Moore for Daniel James, I mean, you know, there was some good attacking by the U.S. in that second half, but once again, that substitution really, really helped out Wales deep into the second half before that penalty that was awarded to Christian Bale was on target for the Welsh.
Well, first of all, where are my manners? Cardick, pleasure to be on with you. Been a fan of your stuff, and I really thought your commentary is always spot on and your observations. And Robert, pleasure to be on with you as well. Yeah, like we were saying, I mean, that was a game changer. That was an in-game adjustment. And credit to Rob Page, his team not only changed it up a little bit more direct, but he also changed their intensity. Whatever the halftime team talk was said should be bottled and saved for later. But we know that the Welsh are going to come play direct with a player like Kiefer Moore in there. He suits that style perfectly. The U.S. didn't have an answer for it, didn't cope for it. And you know what, long stretches in that second half were outplayed. And I'd have to say that, you know, the Welsh were the better team. But for my bone of contention here a lot with our media coverage and I'm hearing it, analysis is that for all of this great play, and it was good play for the U.S. in the first half, between the boxes, there was one shot on target in that game for the United States. And for me, it's got to be better than that. You know, and we're not talking, you know, all due respect to the Welsh, we're not talking about, you know, a top-tier program. Yes, they are in a golden generation and playing extremely well, and no disrespect to them, but, you know, it's not like we're playing the Three Lions or we're playing, you know, Belgium or you know, a top European side. And so I thought the U.S., you know, kind of were outwitted, and that a lot of that's on Greg Berhalter. And also touching on a point that you were making about substitutions, you know, a lot of people clamoring for Gio Reyna when the U.S., you know, were, you know, in dire need of some creative inspiration for all of their play between the boxes. I thought Gio Reyna could have alleviated that and given them a little bit more incision, a little more quality and link play into the final third and, you know, a nose for goal himself. So I take issue with the fact that, yes, it's great what you do between the boxes, but, you know, we know what happens inside those boxes often are the decisive moments and are what decide games. And for me, the U.S. just wasn't good enough in that regard. And, you know, hopefully that we'll see that alleviated up against an England side who, in my estimation, if we play like we did in that second half against the Welsh, we are in for big trouble because we will absolutely – get torn apart by this English side. And I just think it's got to be better. And, you know, in the build up to this World Cup, much has been made about the number nine and the center forward and, you know, whether it's going to be Ferreira, Haji Wright or Josh Sargent, whoever's going to come in. And it's really glaring to me that lack of conviction in that final third is something that it's problematic.
And Robert, just to go on the substitutions in the second half, and I do agree with Christian for the sense of not so much about Gio Reyna coming in or not coming in. Outside of that, which I do agree he should have been in the match without a doubt as a substitute, but the lack of awareness and urgency from Greg Berhalter's substitution patterns really, really bothered me. And I'm going to go all the way back to the home World Cup qualifier back in Tennessee, Nashville, Tennessee, where Greg Berhalter, the only sub he made was in that first half to sub out Serginho Dest for an injury and did not sub anybody into that match for a good 55, 60 minutes. From the Dest injury till it was too late when Canada equalized in that qualifier at home in Nashville. To me, Berhalter is lacking in awareness of when to sub and when not to sub.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I feel like we've, or at least you've talked about this on your show throughout, and you know, qualification, and I'm in agreement with it. The substitute patterns tend to be rather confusing, I think, or head scratching at times. You know, I think it's important to touch on the Gio Reyna thing real quick. It's hard for us to know how hurt he is. Obviously, the player says he's 100% ready to go because almost any player will say they're 100% ready to go. How ready to go he is, you know, I think that's a question. But if he's healthy or even close to healthy, I think, you know, as Christian said, you gotta put him out there. But just the timing, I mean, looking at the substitution pattern, you have, you know, Rob Page, who made the substitution at halftime to change the game. Obviously, that was necessary and smart because they couldn't keep playing the way they were. But, you know, if you look at the first substitution, you know, Brendan Aaronson coming on in the 66th minute, my math skills are very bad, but that's about 20 minutes of Wales having changed the game. And that's an eternity in soccer. And, you know, I think that knowing that, as Casey Keller pointed out on the post game, you know, you have a number of players who are not necessarily getting the time that they may want or coming back from injury. You're perfectly justified in bringing on a quick substitution early in the second half for any number of reasons. But the fact that it was kind of like you had a number of substitutions come on, you know, Yedlin in 74th and, you know, Morris in the 88th and so on and so forth, and Haji Wright in the 73rd minute, it just kind of spoke to a little bit of tinkering a little bit too late. And I think that's the disappointing thing is, you know, Greg Berhalter is going to be stuck with this idea of, like, does he really know how to use his bench? And he didn't prove in this game that – he didn't put those doubts to rest, let's put it that way.
No, he really didn't. And that's the one thing, Kardik, I think was the advantage for Wales was that, as we all saw, Berhalter, you know, basically late with his substitutions. You saw a tired U.S. team being taken advantage of. And it I mean, let's also say it as well. I mean, you know, even the bookings to Tim Ream, that, you know, wasn't good. Even the earlier bookings over to Weston McKennie and I believe also Tyler Adams, but I think it was somebody else that got booked, but I thought Tyler Adams got a yellow card in that match. Dest, thank you, Serginho Dest, getting that earlier booking as well. To me, that really hampered the U.S. from doing anything, you know, important from the goal being scored all the way to where Wales already made their substitution to start that second half. Did we lose Kardik? I guess we did. Now we have him back on. Kardik, did you hear what I said?
Yeah. So I'm glad you mentioned the match in Nashville against Canada last September, because that, to me, was a prototypical match where the U.S. was pretty good in the first half. It was 0-0. But then the first 15 minutes of the second half, Canada were the better team, and Kyle Larin got a goal at the end of that 15-minute stretch, if I remember. Right, they came out at halftime. Herdman had made some tweaks within his team, and Canada gets a goal, basically, and takes the lead. And Berhalter is then scrambling. And then there was a match in Honduras, I think maybe in the same qualifying window, where Berhalter got it right with his changes, but they came late, and we fell behind in the game. I can't remember if it was Honduras or El Salvador. Some of qualifying.
Honduras.
But there was – yeah, it was Honduras, right. And so he then makes – because he had five substitutions, makes a – basically what you would call in hockey a line change, right? He brings on the cavalry and is able to change the match. But again, that those changes came late. And we've seen it repeatedly from him. And in this match, the U.S. was getting battered. And sure, Wales didn't get a goal, but the U.S. was getting battered from minutes 45 to 60. It was about as bad as it could be. And there was not even a tweak within the setup of the 11 guys he had on the pitch. There wasn't a thought, well, maybe we bring one of the attacking players. You know, Josh Sargent can actually play a little deeper. He's very versatile. I've seen him do this at Norwich because they have Timo Pukki, who's an out-and-out number nine. So Sargent, unless they're playing in a two-striker formation, which they don't very often, plays in all sorts of different roles. So you could have even tweaked within that lineup. You could have maybe done something a little differently with the three-man midfield, with McKennie struggling with the injury. But there was no change made. And Matt Turner bailed the U.S. out, flat out, right? He made a great save and then did enough to put Kiefer Moore off on the ensuing corner to where he missed the target on what was basically a free header that was not picked up by the defenders, right? But the keeper did enough, in my estimation, just from watching how he reacted. So this is a recurring theme, guys, and it's something that Berhalter – has to get right, because what we've seen with Berhalter is he either gets his starting 11 right, which we saw at times during qualifying, but then there's some strange substitutions, or he gets his starting 11 wrong, his tactics wrong from the get-go, and has to scramble and often does it late. So he as a consistent manager has not been able to put in a 90-minute shift like you expect your players to do at a high level in I don't know how long, maybe since the Gold Cup last year. It's been that long.
Yeah, it probably has been. And Christian, if I can go to you with this, you know, my problem with Greg Berhalter has always been he's trying to fit players into a system where this is not a club team. You cannot force players to play a system who are not playing that same system anywhere or everywhere else around the world. You as a national team head coach must play to the strengths of the players that you are inheriting so that they can work as a unit and do well. And, you know, outside of Christian Pulisic being that dangerous player to deliver a ball or to set up chances for his teammates like he did for Timothy Weah, we'll get to that goal in a moment, you know, to me, this is a manager for the national team who's lucky enough that the board of directors at U.S. Soccer, forget about the presidential position, Cindy Parlacone, you know, whatever job she's doing, whatever it is, good for her, I don't care. But she doesn't have the nerve to go out and actually do the job to fire a manager the way that a president of the U.S. Soccer Federation or any FA should if their managers for the national team are not doing the job they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, that's I think a discussion for another time. And as we find ourselves in the thick of this World Cup battle, and Berhalter for me is failed. Is his first test. I had to be quite frank. I'm very disappointed with the lack of response, and that I don't know who else to put that on but him. And while there can be debates made about substitutions and such, the fact that it was flat and it was checkmate and there was no response to that, and we can beat a dead horse and such, but the midfield needed to be livened up. He brought on the likes of Jordan Morris because he wanted a little pace, a little more power, even though you've got a side in Wales that match up well in that regard. And you were looking at a U.S. team that it had gone flat in the midfield at that stretch of the game. We're talking, in the last quarter of an hour. And it was in crying out for creative inspiration, in my estimation, as I thought Yunus Musa, just kind of ran out of steam a little bit. And Aaron McKinney had to come off. So that left a little bit of a hole in terms of, thrust and force. And it kind of affected the U.S. presence in the attacking half. And you've got to have an answer for that. You have to. And if anything we've seen throughout this World Cup, these in-game adjustments, are proving to be massive for a lot of these teams here. We saw it, in previous games. And I think that is something that, is a major barometer for any manager. And hopefully it won't be the case against an England team that is going to be well up for this fight. And as I mentioned earlier, it's got to be a heck of a lot better. While you want that same type of effort and its same productivity between the boxes, and much praise to the U.S. for that effort in the first half, but decisive areas, decisive moments, the U.S. needs to have that conviction, and we need to get that. And a lot of that falls on the manager.
No, I agree. And let me just say this, Robert, to talk about that goal first from the U.S., I thought Pulisic delivered a hell of a ball. I thought Tim Weah did an excellent job to stay onside, to be on the inside of his defender. And then when he got to the ball, nice quick poke, slotted it home, and 1-0 U.S. And I really thought that we're going to see a big, big three-pointer for the U.S. until, of course, the moment that second half happened. We'll get to that in a moment. But still, though, Robert, great goal by Timmy Weah. And at the same time, how nice his father, the president of Liberia and the former Ballon d'Or winner in George Weah, taking time away from his presidential duties for his country to watch his son play in the World Cup. That was amazing.
Yeah, I think, there are stories like that throughout every World Cup, and I'll start there. And I love the pictures afterwards. I love that story and the fact that, obviously his father hasn't necessarily played at that, at a World Cup, but having be able to watch his son and score a goal those are the kind of heartwarming stories I wish we could see more of at this World Cup, but we won't go down that road right now. why we're not hearing those as much. Let's talk about the goal. So I think that's, like I said earlier, it's a perfect combination of where the U.S. was able to play to its strengths kind of in the first half. As was pointed out in the broadcast, really, Joe Rondon and a couple of, the Wales defense was playing a little bit, scattershot. And so when you have Christian Pulisic and you give him space like that, he can really excel. And I think that's where we saw the best of him there, given a little bit of space and a defense that's a little bit on the back foot. He was able to pick out that pass. And as we said with Timmy Weah, he was having a heck of a time down that side of the field in the first half. I thought he was really playing well. And as you mentioned, Daniel, just getting into a great position to receive that pass really highlights what the U.S. can do well when given the time and space and the defensive disorganization to do that. The problem is that are they going to get that much time and space in the next match? Probably not. Not to get too ahead of ourselves, but, you know, it's not very often you're going to get golden opportunities like that. But it's good to see the U.S., and that's one of the reasons why I was really encouraged by the first half and hoping, like I said, for another goal is because, you know, they were playing well and playing to their strengths. And then, you know, I was hoping – I knew it wasn't going to last, so it was good to see that one goal.
Yeah, and Cardiff, you know, for Wales, they get their goal off a penalty from Gareth Bale. Who else but Gareth Bale? Of course, we saw that in the MLS Cup final for LAFC in second half stoppage time. Actually, I should say second half extra time stoppage time to make it 3-3 against the Philadelphia Union and force the penalty kick shootout. But Walker Zimmerman, honestly, I know he was trying to defend Bale when he got the ball. I think his decision-making to go into a sliding tackle was absolutely the wrong way to go, because when you're going to take on Gareth Bale like that, you got to face – you got to really challenge him head-on, you know, head-on, keep your feet above and not go right down to the floor, because you're going to put yourself in a big, big heap of trouble, because you know Gareth Bale is a very big player who will change a match very, very quickly if you give him the opportunity.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I agree with that analysis. And he shouldn't have lost his feet when he did and how he did, and it was a clear penalty. But I think a key thing to consider is that the U.S. had the action coming at them for so much of the second half. And Wales were winning the 50-50 balls. And we talked about Berhalter not making the changes when he needed to make. That at that point, you were seeing a mentally fatigued mistake by Walker Zimmerman. A mistake based on that that he and Timmy Ream, his center back partnership, had to clean up so much in the second half after having not to do very much in the first half. And I think those sorts of mistakes happen because you're mentally tired. They keep coming at you. You know Wales is desperate. They're throwing more and more forward. You've somehow gotten through that first wave. We talked about minutes 45 to 60 where Matt Turner made a great save. Wales made a couple had a couple of other really good opportunities. Berhalter took his time making a change to try and change the trajectory of the match and adjust in midfield where Wales were winning every 50-50 ball. So I think this is partly a result of the lack of tactical change from Berhalter, to be honest with you,
yep.
And the inability to relieve the pressure that the U.S. defenders were under that entire second half. Wales was going to get a goal one way or another. It felt like that whole – from minute 46 onward, it felt like that. And so it happened this way, unfortunately, for Walker Zimmerman.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, that's the thing right now, guys, is that my issue with Berhalter has always been his lack of vision when it comes to what's being played in front of him. It's not just forcing players into a system that, you know, for a national team is not supposed to happen. But when does he feel he needs to make the right substitutions at the right time? Because once again, it's not just that, you know, this match was screaming for Gio Reyna. His evaluations, Christian, to say that Jordan Morris brings more speed into the game when he was subbed in that late into the match, which I completely disagree with. Jordan Morris, to me, granted, he's able to run with the ball very well. He's able to get into spaces very well. But, I mean, to be honest with you, he's better moving without the ball, and at the same time, he's better being a target striker than actually using his speed with the ball to create a chance. He's a better target striker. He's a better movement without the ball guy to get that moment to score the goal, whether it's on the Sounders or whether it's on the men's national team. Because, yes, that moment is more for Reyna, who has the speed and able to attack when you need that second goal to retake the lead.
Yeah, I think what Berhalter was thinking was he was as Wales was going to go and pressing for the winner late on, bringing on a player like Jordan Morris would allow the U.S. to counterattack with pace and power, and that's where we know that, you know, Jordan Morris is at his best, is when he's, you know, in transition, facing up and running at defenders and trying to play and attack space. And I think that was his rationale. And I can see what he's doing that. But, you know, aside from those moments, he's a player that struggles breaking down a low block. A lot of these U.S. players, I think, really struggle breaking down in a low block, particularly Christian Pulisic, which is, you know, they made a lot of critical points towards his play has been tackled in overseas media. And one bone of contention I had as well with the substitution pattern, the likes of Acosta coming on for Musa. Clearly Musa was tired. I thought he should have come off a little earlier, and that's where people get into this Gio Reyna argument. You bring in, you know, Kellen Acosta to get some control, get a foothold in midfield when the U.S. were being, you know, outplayed in that direct fashion. But that was the sub, I think, that a lot of people were looking at and scratching their heads and going, you know, okay, here we are. We're looking for 3 points. Wales is up and at us right now, and he wanted to get a foothold of the game and bring in Costa to just kind of lock things down. I don't think it worked, and that's where we were outwitted. I agree wholeheartedly with, you know, Kartik's point where, you know, you need to make a change. I mean, you know, it sounds cliche, but a plan B, whatever you want to call it, you have to be able to make those changes and adjust to the situation that's presented in front of you, and we didn't. That's flat out.
No, we didn't.
In a World Cup, when you've got tight turnarounds, you know, and you don't have a lot of time to work, and especially in this World Cup where there hasn't been much chance to really, you know, work with these players in the lead up to it and work on systems, it doesn't really suit the strengths of a manager like Greg Berhalter, who's such a fan of the system and likes to have his players in camp for long durations. So, yeah, I mean, it was just a substitution pattern that I thought was mysterious, I don't agree with, and the personnel, you know, implemented. If Gio Reyna is not fit to go, then he should not be a part of the 18. He's in the 18, so he is available for selection. So that's on the manager. If he's not fit and, you know, you're worried about fitness issues, then don't include him in your 18. So, and that's where I have some issues with him and the way he's gone about his business. I'm not going to be doom and gloom on him. You know, he's pushed a lot of the right buttons. I thought the 4-3-3 idea and from the get-go, I thought he picked a good team. I really did. A lot of eyebrows are raised with Ream. I thought Dest looked, you know, Jorginho Dest, you know, great on the front foot, but, you know, players were running at him, and that was several times he had it crammed down his throat, and he looked very uncomfortable, shaky, and of course, I thought kind of was the catalyst to the first substitution, or second substitution, rather, bringing on Yedlin. Dest was on that yellow card, I'm trying to think ahead to the England game. So, yeah, there's some tweaks, and I'm sure, you know, the coaching staff is going to take a long, hard look at this video because there's a lot that they got wrong that they can get right, just in terms of organization, in terms of a tactical standpoint.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And Robert, just to go on a big moment, I thought, and obviously this can be said for football, as you can also say for hockey. Know when to take a penalty at the right time, meaning, of course, a foul. Know when to take a foul at the right time when it's a smart foul or a smart penalty, because you're trying to prevent the opposition from gaining an advantage when you know that the numbers are not in favor for you. And Kellen Acosta, you know, look, he did what he had to do to save Matt Turner from being exposed when he ran 20 yards off of his line to defend the ball to try and kick away. And if Kellen Acosta does not pull his man down, and yes, he got booked for it, but as we say in the business, that's the right type of foul you want to do. And you know what? That's the yellow card you know that you can accept, the fans can accept, media can accept, and your head coach will accept you because, you know, you made a sacrifice to take a booking to save a goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely a professional foul there. Really smart play. You know, and this is, like you mentioned, true in hockey, and most every sport is sometimes you just got to commit that foul. But you have to do it in a way that's smart. You know, you don't want to, like, pack somebody down and, you know, get yourself a red late in the match or, you know, miss. How many times have we seen a player try to commit a foul and just whiff completely? So it's a little bit harder than it looks. So credit to him for having the wherewithal to sit there and look back and say, okay, here's what I need to do to prevent, you know, us from being in a really bad place and losing a point here. So I think you're right to highlight that. And I know many others have as well. It's a good, smart play. to, you know, preserve that tie. And, you know, I think that's one of the benefits of having some of these players. You know, I know all of these players have had, or pretty much all of these players have had a lot of actual soccer, professional soccer experience, but sometimes it helps to have, you know, some of that, your high-level experience and very tight matches when all of the pressure's on you. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff that we're going to see, you know, that's good to see from this U.S. team. They're not, I know we're, I think the youngest or the second youngest roster, but sometimes it's good to see that veteran smarts come through.
Carrick, what would you say would be Wales's point of view in this match? I think we all agree with the U.S.'s end of things that this probably should have been a 3-point win. This should have been at least 1-0 or 2-0 for the U.S. against Wales. But when you see the result for the Welsh, what do you think they're saying right now? Do you think they felt that they deserve the point, that they might have found a way to get 3 points out of this one? Do you think they deserve the loss in this?
Yeah, so there's actually been in the British media a lot of talk about the foul, the tactical foul, the professional foul that Robert just spoke about regarding Kellen Acosta, which I think was perfectly timed. You take the yellow card there, you do what he did. I don't have any problem with it. But there's been some conversation in the British media, hey, that was really cynical, and the U.S. stole a point by doing that. Well, I guess you could say that because potentially Bale get that shot off. There's, I think, considering it's Gareth Bale, there's a better than 50-50 chance it goes in the back of the net and Wales wins. But beyond that, there's been some conversation about Rob Page and the selection, and not just how tactically the mistake of not starting Kiefer Moore from the beginning and not having, in my opinion, the mistake of not having Brennan Johnson in there from the beginning also, but the lack of intensity. And that Wales had qualified with a lot of spirit and cohesion, and had, even though they had lost those matches I mentioned in the UEFA Nations League to the Dutch and to the Belgian side, you know, two elite sides in world football, that they had played with this spirit and this fight throughout those matches, and that they came into a match against the United States, who are respected and are seen as a side that's dangerous, that they played so scared in their first World Cup since 1958. So, this is a Welsh side that has gotten out of the group stage in the last two Euros. They got to the semifinals of Euro 2016. So they're an experienced side at the international level, but they haven't been in a World Cup before. So there's a lot of analysis about that and thinking, okay, they could have won the match, but they'll take the point and move on. And now there is some talk that, look, maybe they're in a position where, because they get England in the last game, you know, just from an emotional standpoint, what it means for Wales to play England, that maybe they're in a pretty good position, because maybe they're better positioned to get a point off of England than the United States is. So assuming they beat Iran. So that's kind of been the talk in the British press from the Welsh perspective. They're relieved they got a point. They think they could have won, but they're also really not happy with how the match started and realized very easily they could have been down 2 or 3-0 at halftime.
You know, Christian, we talk so much about our players, our national team, and, you know, mm-hmm. the golden generation that just got started for this national team that Greg Berhalter is managing right now. I mean, we see what they do match in, match out, regardless whether you watch it on linear television, the streaming that's been going on through Peacock, Paramount Plus, ESPN Plus, BN Sports Plus, whatever have you. I would say maybe more than half of this roster plays in Europe, and maybe a quarter of it is in England, or at least in the United Kingdom, you know, through Rangers and Celtic, the Premier League, Championship, Serie A, Bundesliga, even in La Liga at a time. I mean, is this the most talented roster we have had maybe since 2002, before we had all these players going to Europe that dominated the U.S. men's national team roster?
I think without question, in terms of individual, you know, abilities, in terms of individual accomplishments at the club level, this U.S. team is far more accomplished than any other U.S. team in World Cup history. What they've done as a team, that is the huge question mark. 10 of the first 11, you know, were European-based players. But they have yet to prove anything. They have yet to do anything that the previous generation has done. That 0-2 team that was, you know, not expected to do a whole lot was brilliant and you know, came together with the right synergy at the right time. And, you know, it was kind of everything aligned. And you know, through the brilliance of their organization and you know, tactical acumen at the time and a little bit of good luck, they got as far as they did. But this U.S. team, you know, we forget Robert was saying how young it is. You know, it is one of the youngest teams we've ever had. I think it's the youngest World Cup team we've ever put out. But, you know, the inexperience showed to me a lot. You know, when plan A was working fine, but the change comes in, how do you adjust? The players themselves couldn't figure that out. They tired. And one thing I thought was really interesting, too, I mean, throughout qualifying, the U.S. doesn't see a lot of a team that plays in the fashion that Wales does when they go direct. And, you know, they play with five at the back. And, you know, especially when they kind of turned up the heat in terms of being on the front foot in the second half. The U.S. is not used to that type of football. They're not used to that type of opponent. They may get some of it at their club level, but as a team in the international stage, this team has not experienced that together as a group. There's no substitution for that. You know, stability is the cornerstone of success, is what Arsene Wenger used to say, and the U.S. is developing that. So they have to go through that as a group together. And they're going to be a little wet behind the ears, and naivete is showing, and it showed, you know, from the manager, it showed on our players. I think it's just part of the natural process. And you're going to see, it's going to be interesting to see how the U.S. adjusts to playing in Iran, which is going to be, you know, similarly the same that we saw from Wales, where, you know, they're going to be hard to break down. There's going to be some S-housery out there. They're going to be difficult to play against, despite the scoreline against England. So that will be fascinating to see how it comes about and U.S. getting a taste of different styles for the first time as a group than they've ever encountered.
Robert, I know it's only been one group stage match for the World Cup for Greg Berhalter, but if we can look at the whole right now, or if you can't answer it right now, I understand, it's fine, but if I can throw this out to you anyway, when you compare what Greg Berhalter has done so far to what Bruce Arena did as U.S. men's national team manager, or what Bob Bradley did, or what even Jurgen Klinsmann did, where would you compare what Greg Berhalter has done so far to those three men?
Yeah, that's a big question, and I'm going to take the easy way out and say we'll see, you know, having only been one match in. I will say this, though. If you're looking at specifically just World Cup performances, the next match is a pretty big, you know, pretty big test for the U.S. And I think it's a pretty big opportunity to, you know, establish your credentials in the World Cup if you're Greg Berhalter. So you should be like very excited about this next match as an opportunity to, you know, show off a little bit for the international crowd. But you know, I think, you know, we've highlighted throughout this show kind of like where we think the shortcomings are and some of the strengths are of Greg Berhalter. And I think, you know, the key thing is can he adjust himself and his coaching style to the realities of this World Cup? I mean, every World Cup is different. There's always some sort of weird nuances, you know, with a World Cup, whether it's a location or a time of year. This year is certainly very new. But, you know, when you look back at some of the managers who find success, some of it's luck, but some of it's also this opportunity, you know, this ability to sit and look at the situation and make adjustments. And, you know, we've mentioned a couple of times here, the inability to make adjustments is the biggest concern for this U.S. team. There's certainly talent. You know, is there enough talent to keep advancing? You know, that's certainly a debatable point. But the big question is can the manager and the technical staff make these adjustments? And if the answer is no, then, well, I mean, that's going to find itself out real quick here in the next match or two. So, I mean, the road ahead for the U.S. is fraught not only just with England but with Iran after that for a number of reasons. So this is if you're Greg Berhalter and his technical team, you're excited about the opportunity to prove yourselves almost as much, if not more so, than the players are.
And, Kardik, obviously Christian Pulisic gets tons of guff from American fans, from the American media, from the English media playing for Chelsea, for what he has or has not done on a club level. But if I can ask you this, do you think he had a better free-flowing game in this first group stage matchup against Wales than he would probably in his club side?
In terms of the way Wales played in the first half, yes, because he was given the freedom of movement, got a lot of touches on the ball, was able to use Josh Sargent as kind of a hold-up player, play off of him really well. Second half, very different. Wales were winning the 50 balls. They were winning the ball further up the pitch. I think one of my biggest criticisms of Pulisic through the years has been I feel like his positioning sense when his team is on the back foot, and I said this when he was at Borussia Dortmund, I've seen a little of it at Chelsea also, but it was really a problem his last season at Dortmund, isn't very good, right? He's often in the wrong place. He's often not making the right runs in those moments when his team is not in possession or when his team is not on the front foot. And I saw a lot of that in the second half of this game. That having been said, there were several opportunities in the second half, despite the fact that the Welsh dominated the second half, where the U.S. were able to break through that kind of higher press and Wales' intensity. And the final ball was lacking, or the run was not made. And a lot of that was Pulisic. So it was a tale of two halves for him. Should mention that on ITV, Roy Keane has said that at Chelsea, Pulisic is generally bad one match, decent another, and then brilliant in another. So that's three matches, right, for Chelsea. So in a three-match group stage, the Wales was kind of the iffy game. So it's possible he's brilliant against England, probably Keane, and then very bad against Iran or vice versa. So he, based on that analysis from the way he plays at the club level, and I think Keane is right, he might have a brilliant game in him against England.
Okay, well, so let's go ahead and preview that game, guys. Christian, we'll go to you first. Where do you think is the most important thing right now that Berhalter needs to do to prepare for England? And where do you see the strengths for that matchup on Friday, Black Friday here in the States, of course?
I really would like to see more play through this right-hand side where I thought Timothy Weah found his footing early on, especially in the first 15 minutes or so. We saw Monday against Wales. Speaking on the right side, I think that's going to be problematic for the U.S. I think Jedi Robinson, and whether it be Musa, even Pulisic to an extent, is going to be facing a lot of Kieran Trippier, a lot of Jude Bellingham, and Saka, who was brilliant against the Iranians. A lot of the attacking movement from England was done, you know, on those overloads on that side. So that could be presenting a difficult test for the United States. And the U.S., I think, will profit from the fact that they will be playing a direct opponent that will, you know, sit back with five and try and handle a break. There's a little more space and room to operate, and I think that could suit the strengths of a Christian Pulisic. One thing I do find ironic, and it came to mind when Kartik was making his observation too, Pulisic is one of those players that is almost he's a wide midfield player. He's not an out-and-out winger, and when we play with this 4-3-3 setup, you know, it's the system is predicated on width and winger play traditionally. And we don't have that, you know, with a Christian Pulisic. He's not an out-and-out winger. He's not going to stretch and pull your defense apart. He's going to make those, you know, incisive runs. And when he finds space underneath, you know, and flip those balls in like we saw with Timothy Weah, that's where he's at his best. So a change of shape might be on the cards. I really don't think it's going to happen. It'd be something that might be contemplated. Of course, the shape changes when you're in possession and out of possession. But yeah, sometimes the width is puzzling for me. We do see some runs from Robinson, and of course, Jorginho Dest when he's included on that right inside to provide a lot of that width and make those overlaps over Pulisic. But you know, in terms of that front third, you don't see that in this 4-3-3 system, which is a little strange, a little bit of a caveat than a traditional 4-3-3 setup. So. But with space, I think the U.S. will have more room to operate. It could suit their strength because they do have the athleticism. It's going to be a massive game for Tyler Adams, who I thought was very good against the Welsh. And he's going to get stuck in. He's going to have to take charge. He's going to have his hands full. Sterling was on form. He continues his great form at the international level. Talk about Saka, how brilliant he's been. He's really finding his feet at the right time. And Jude Bellingham is is turning into a midfielder of the next generation for this English team. Is what a talent. So the midfield matchups, this MMA, whatever you want to call it, is going to be up for it because they really will have their hands full. And then you throw in the likes of a Harry Kane, who will drop in deep and play the role of facilitator like we saw in large stretches. Hard to believe that England scores six and Harry Kane doesn't get one of them. Yeah, he did play a significant role in the English buildup. I was very impressed with the English. And one thing that we haven't addressed, but also to set pieces, much was made of it during the in-game commentary and some of it, that the U.S. will have to be on it, really have to be on it defensively. It's got to be better marking. I thought there were a series of three headers from the Welsh that were unpunished. But with Harry Maguire up there, who's one of the best in the air, and then John Stones able to play out, but chiefly Maguire in good service, you know, whether it be from Shaw and Trippier, it's going to be something that the U.S. really has to be better in defending because, you know, England has made that one of their staples of their attack.
And Robert, just to throw this at you about, you know, for the starting 11 for the U.S., I mean, I don't have a problem with Pulisic playing wide to the left in the top three in the 4-3-3 formation that Berhalter has done. And I don't mind Sargent being in the middle either, but I think for this one, and I really think in my mind, if we're really going to have a solid attacking function, England on their heels in this one, would you move Pulisic centrally up top and maybe have Brendan Aaronson starting the match on the left by keeping Weah on the right?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would answer your question in a slightly different way, which is I would be curious to see Christian Pulisic move around a little bit more in this match. So maybe if you're going to start him centrally, see if he'll move out to the, you know, drift wide or basically find space where he can, you know, be productive and be most useful for the United States. I think that's the big thing. I'll defer a lot of the tactical talk to my colleagues here who are much smarter in this than I am. But I think going back to our earlier point, you know, we want to make sure that Pulisic is move around throughout this match. He's going to need to move to find space, and is Greg Berhalter going to be able to, you know, give him the freedom to kind of move around and still direct him? Because, you know, just to touch on this match from a larger perspective for me, this match is terrifying for a number of reasons. Most of all, that if you're England and looking at this match, if you can get the 3 points from this match, I would much rather have six. If I'm looking at this match and getting 6 points heading into the Wales match, I'm feeling good because I do not want to worry about having to get a result with Wales. Not because, you know, Wales is at an equal quality. They're not. But any emotional impact of a last game of the group stage versus, you know, your fellow countrymen is not, and I know they don't think of themselves necessarily that way, is not something I want to do. I want to take care of business in this match. And so knowing that England's going to be looking to just get the 3 points from this and rotate players for the final match, that scares me a little bit about this match because we're not going to see an England that's down like we did in the first half of the Wales match. This is going to be an England team that's up for this game.
And Kartik, you know, your thoughts about England right now. Obviously, to me, Harry Kane, obviously there's been some reports he suffered an injury in the first match against Iran. Is he fit enough to be into this one? What do you think is going to happen with Southgate running this English squad against the U.S.? And at the same time, on the U.S. end of things, if Tyler Adams is going to be marking Harry Kane in the U.S.'s area, I have to go back to the match between Leeds and Tottenham where, you know, Tyler Adams, even though he tried to position himself to defend against Harry Kane, Kane was able to muscle him off a bit and get that goal, even though I still felt that shouldn't have been a goal in the first place for Tottenham because I thought Meslier was fouled in his little six-yard box in the net and was shoved into the net. I thought that goal should not have counted, but outside of that, I just want to see Tyler Adams, if he is going to be marking Harry Kane, do a better job on the national level than what he did in the Premier League matchup a week or two ago.
Yeah, I mean, if Kane plays that creates a whole set of challenges. He's as good in the world as any number nine in linking up. A lot of what Harry Kane does, besides score goals, is his understanding, his ability to kind of hold the ball, play a ball pass to Raheem Sterling. Bukayo Saka has really come on both for Arsenal and for England in the last 18 months. So very, very dangerous. If he doesn't play, I'm assuming it'll be Callum Wilson, who gives you another set of challenges, right? He's a player that can drift into wide areas. He's a player that I've seen previously at Bournemouth when he played for Eddie Howe, and then he's playing for Eddie Howe again at Newcastle. But when he played at Bournemouth in particular, could drift into midfield and link up and have runners who are coming from wide positions make diagonal runs in behind him, and he would play a pass. So this creates a number of challenges for the U.S. defense. Christian mentioned how good Maguire is in the air. And another point on Harry Maguire is how good he is defensively in the air. His last season at Leicester, before he moved to Manchester United, they didn't concede a single goal from a corner kick all season because of how good Harry Maguire is defensively in the air. So if the U.S. is looking for a smash and grab, which may come down to a set piece, because we're assuming the U.S. will have less of the ball in this match, maybe not as many chances in the run of play, Maguire, Stones, they're going to be big factors. I think something the U.S. has to be very, very conscious of is the ability of Trippier to get forward and play across into the area, his set-piece-taking ability. Obviously, no Kyle Walker for England, so that's a bit of a break for the United States. But there's just so much danger in this matchup. The one thing I do like about facing England is I think England's midfield does not have that sort of ball winner or destroyer you used to associate with England. So, or even kind of the really deep-lying playmaker. Declan Rice is not really a number six. Bellingham is more of a box-to-box guy. Calvin Phillips, who could have played that role, sort of played that role in the Euros, is injured. He's not at the World Cup. So they don't really have that guy, which gives the U.S.'s three-man midfield an opportunity maybe to assert some control over the match. But I think outside of that midfield situation, and I should say, Bellingham and Rice are elite players. I'm not knocking them. I'm just saying that they don't have the kind of cover in midfield, England doesn't, that they do in at the fullback position, even with Walker injured, at the wide positions, up top. They have stacked in these areas. In fact, Southgate's dilemma is who to play, right? He has so many top players at his disposal. But that might be one place for the U.S., which gets back to your question, Daniel. Tyler Adams very much will be the key to this match because he's the guy who's going to have to dictate tempo and dictate play in that midfield and probably have to keep an eye on Bellingham's runs because we've seen Bellingham this season for Borussia Dortmund get even better with these deep runs from midfield. He kind of ghosted Frank Lampard-like runs, like what we used to see from Lampard for both England and for Chelsea. And actually got a goal. He got a goal that way against Iran in the first match. So I think Adams might be the key both ways, offensively and defensively, for the United States.
I agree with you there, Kardik. And you know what, gentlemen? This is going to be an interesting time. And this coming Friday, Thanksgiving Friday, Black Friday, as we all love to call it here, and it's more due to shopping prices and special giveaways. Unfortunately, I have no giveaway to hand out. this will be the third time in the history between the United States and England that they will be facing each other in a World Cup group stage match. We can't forget what happened in 1950. Back in Brazil, in Belo Horizonte, 1-0. South Africa in 2010, the 1-1 draw. And Rob Green, of course, with the howler, helped the U.S. get that equalizer. And this is a very big moment now because either this current squad for our side either continues it or England finally gets that opportunity to say, you know, they've beaten one of the jinxes that they have handled for such a long period of time. But, you know, we'll get to that on Friday when the match is over, and that will be seen live, 2 o'clock Eastern, 11 o'clock in the morning Pacific, as we get ready for the U.S. taking on the English on Fox for this 2022 FIFA World Cup. I want to thank again Christian Miles. I want to thank Robert Hay and Carter Krishnar for joining me today. They'll be back with me on Friday for a post-game after the U.S. faces England in this World Cup group stage match. Gentlemen, thank you again for joining me, and have a good afternoon. Enjoy the holidays. Happy Thanksgiving to you and your family, and talk to you guys again on Friday.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
All right, and this is Daniel Feuerstein. Once again, thank you for joining us today here on the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. As always, please enjoy your football and talk to you guys on Friday. Take care, so long, and bye-bye for now.